Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, behind fatal shootings of African Americans, race relations, police culture, and society. And first, are some green solutions unhelpful for the environment, or worse, do they actually harm it? Over the past few years, more and more green solutions have emerged to address environmental crises. But our next guest says that some of these amount to lazy environmentalism and may have a dark side effect of camouflaging a larger problem. Heather Rogers argues that our current socioeconomic system depends on pollution to maintain its own well-being. And if so, what are the real solutions? Heather Rogers joins us now. She's a journalist and author of Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Welcome.
Thank you, Maria.
I want to actually start with this concept of lazy environmentalism.
Sure.
And what you mean by it.
Right. It's not a term that I coined. It's something that has some currency in the newer generation of environmentalism, which eschews the guilt, you know, and the sacrifice of the environmentalism that came up in the 1970s. It's the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, saying, okay, we don't have to suffer. We can live in nice houses and we can live well and we can drive where we want to drive in hybrid cars and enjoy ourselves. And we can use the market mechanisms in order to have a good life and save the planet. I don't know if that really works.
Because you actually argue that you don't think it does at all and might even make it worse in some ways.
Well, what happens is the way that the market works is that it has to grow. And in order to do that, it has to utilize materials in nature. It can't stop extracting and affecting the natural environment, ecosystems that we need in order to hold back climate change, in order to keep our water clean and diverse species all over the planet. What I'm saying is that, you know, there's this fundamental logic that we can't undo by replacing green products for dirty ones. You know, that fundamental logic is still there, where wealth comes from.
It still comes from the ground and it still comes from nature. And I wonder if it's just a part of being human that we are exploiting nature. How do you counteract that?
Right. We have to use resources. And what I argue at the end of the book is that, you know, I'm not saying we don't take anything from nature, because we do. And we have an interrelationship with nature. There's a term for it, socioecology. It's this idea that social networks and environmental networks do coexist. We've always used nature to support life,
yeah.
Right? So how can we do that without wrecking the place? And we know that it can be done because societies have done it in the past. Current societies are doing it, you know, to varying degrees now. And it's just a matter of looking beyond the role of ourselves as individual consumers and the choices that we make and looking at the larger picture.
So what you're not arguing is that people should stop doing the green things like the reusable bags and the reusable cups and any of that. You're not arguing that. You're saying it just may not be enough.
But there are some, you know, quote unquote, green products that are really bad.
Let's talk about some of those. You talked about a few of them. Some of them include this label of organic food, and sometimes it's a little deceptive.
I would say that locally grown organic food environmentally is very sound. I looked also at globally grown organic. Increasingly, as big corporations take over the organic food industry, they are sourcing organic inputs from all over the world, developing countries primarily. So I ended up in Paraguay on an organic sugar plantation, which supplies a third of all the organic sugar consumed in the United States. This plantation is doing things like clearing trees, clearing native ecosystem to expand its organic cropland. This doesn't make environmental sense. It makes economic sense. And yes, they're not spraying the crops with chemicals, and that's better, but they're pulling apart these vital ecosystems that can't be replaced, at least not anytime soon. Biofuels, for example, the government mandates consumption of biofuels in this country, in Europe, in parts of China, and in many other countries around the globe. It's increasingly popular because it's seen as a green, renewable energy. What's happening in places like Indonesian Borneo, where I went and spent some time in the rainforest in some indigenous villages, is that they are clear-cutting one of the last large remaining rainforests on the planet, to grow crops for biofuels. Where I was the last remaining viable habitat for the orangutan.
You actually visited one farm that you considered kind of beyond organic, the Morse Pitts, Windfall Farms in New York, and he was really struggling.
Yeah.
So talk to us about the broader implications of that.
This is the other side of the economics of organic. The small local farmer is hailed as the hero of this wave of environmentalism and the transformation of the food system. And what I found is that so many of these farmers have a really hard time making ends meet, even though they charge quite a bit of money for the produce that they make, but their costs are so high and there's such a dearth of infrastructure for them.
These independent, quasi-independent agencies that certify, they also have these huge corporations like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland on the board. Did you have a sense that that is just compromising their standards?
Corporations were founding members, and it was a partnership that they entered into with the World Wildlife Fund. And there are some other environmental groups that participate. One of the plantations I visited where this plantation company is illegally deforesting, they're making the refining palm oil, which they sell to a company called Wilmar, which is partially owned by Archer Daniels Midland. So you have this dispossession of native indigenous communities, absolutely wiping out of this rainforest and burning the trees once they've been cut down. And that kind of forest clearance has made Indonesia the third largest CO2 emitter globally. This is a country without developed industries. It trails only the U.S. and China in its CO2 emissions because of all the deforestation.
You are not somebody who says more regulation is really going to help. You address the socially responsible business kind of approach, that what you even call the triple bottom line. And it sounded like you didn't have a lot of faith in it.
I don't, because I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the economic system. There's a critique in this. It's often referred to as natural capitalism or green capitalism. Natural capitalism says we need the government to come in. So natural capitalism is an interpretation of capitalism that says you can clean up the environment, you can green your business, and all of this will save you money, make your enterprise more efficient, and it will win over customers. And in this economic system, because it does have to grow, that energy goes back into expanding the business and intensifying, you know, making new markets and further intensifying consumption. So it's not like you retire those savings. So when Walmart replaces its truck fleet with more fuel efficient vehicles, it's not like the greenhouse gases that aren't being made are just put away. Walmart opens another store and another store and another store.
Let's talk about ecological housing units that you saw in Europe. You seemed inspired by them.
You know, I look at what's not working, but I also look at what's working. I went to Germany to the town of Freiburg, which is referred to often by people as an eco-village, housing a total of 15,000 people. They've been around for over a dozen years, and so they have this track record. You know, is it comfortable, weird? You know, is it like culturally kind of alienating? And what I found was that it was very accessible, and it's different for different people, of course.
What is it about it that works?
What works is that they've built buildings using passive house methods, which is a super insulated building method and very well-made components that hold as much energy. In Germany, about 3/4 of all CO2 emissions come from heating of the building emissions. So it's really important to have really well-insulated structures. There's also buildings in this neighborhood that actually produce more energy than they use. They all have solar panels as their roofs. And something that the German government is doing is they have this thing which is called the feed-in tariff. How it works is regular people can put solar panels on their house. They plug those solar panels into the grid, and the utility is obliged to buy power from them for 20 years at double the going rate. So that means that individuals can pay off their solar panels in 7 to 8 years, and then they get a dozen years of pure profit. So it becomes financially doable for them, because with renewable energy, all the costs are up front. And with coal, we get to spread those costs out over time. And it's not something that the government is paying for in Germany. All the ratepayers chip in, so everyone's participating. I'm not totally opposed to regulation. I think that everything kind of plays a role, but there has to be ways that we use all the different, you know, mechanisms that we have in ways that make the most sense.
Okay, now let's end with transportation. And one of the things that you're critical of is the carbon offset. First of all, talk about what the carbon offset is and what Sure. your considerations are. Where do we go from here?
So carbon offsetting is available to regular consumers. It's a voluntary product that we can buy. When you get an airplane ticket, say, there's often now an option on the website to say, you know, offset my carbon from this flight and pay $10 or $15 extra. And that money goes to a company that then partners with nonprofits typically on the ground in places most often in developing countries. China and India are the number one sites of carbon offset projects. I went to India, where a quarter of all the world's offsetting projects are being carried out. And what I found is that, you know, it sounds great. I emitted this carbon. I paid this money. Now my conscience is clear. Except it doesn't quite work like that. Carbon can only be neutralized over time. So if you plant a tree, it's not until the full lifespan of that tree is over that carbon has been absorbed. That might take 100 years. And clearly we need carbon to be reduced now. And then there are other issues with carbon offsetting, like do the projects actually get carried out at all? There can be really unintended consequences. One of the places I went to was a renewable energy plant that was supposed to run on crop wastes. And what was happening is that it's in this very poor farming region, and people are cutting down trees to sell to the plant to earn extra money. There's all kinds of possible snags that are really hard to anticipate when you're sitting at your computer and you want to do the right thing. What we need to do, I think, is to really not accept an oversimplification of the situation we're in and why we're here. From what I saw on the ground, carbon offsetting, it can't take carbon out of the atmosphere.
Tell us how we should approach this now.
We need to practice our environmentalism in a range of ways, not just through what we buy. Part of that environmentalism, the way that we can practice it is by educating ourselves. I think if we can expand environmentalism to include the social, we see environmental crisis so in such a compartmentalized way. And I think if we can start to open that up and understand the connections between the social, the economic, and the environmental, we can really start making some progress that is based on hope and not based on false hope.
Thank you, Heather Rogers. The book is called Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. Thank
Maria,
you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, behind fatal shootings of African Americans, race relations, police culture, and society. Stay tuned.
Wishes them in the broken heart, feel the open palm, part in my flowing thoughts, my departure from the norm, the past is more warm, war torn from the marching of your armies and the dropping of your bombs. The walking on the waters now, stomping on the pond, the ripples now wave. You can't be peaceful with a pistol in your face. You can't beat the people, so you're picking on their place. I jump to defend, I'm waged with a page. My pen's mightier than them, and I got missiles on the stage. It's couches for the cowards, it stretches for the brave. And I happily lay upon the bed that I have made. Like housekeep, sheets and pillowcase, but I don't sleep. Dreams is keeping me awake. They went up thinking that they had never touched the ground. But we gon' wish upon them all.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Police in the United States have shot and killed more than 500 people in the first half of 2015, according to a count by The Guardian. In fact, the police in the U.S. have killed more in a matter of days than other countries do in years. Most victims are African American. Three experts join us now to help us understand what exactly is going on. Dr. Kimberly Barsamian Khan is a professor of social psychology at Portland State University. She's the author of Racial Bias in Policing: Why We Know Less Than We Should. Alan Zhao is a professor of law and justice at Rowan University. He is the author of Controlling Police Corruption and Misconduct, a comparative examination between Hong Kong and New York, as well as Police Auditing Theories and Practices. Ronald Kramer also joins us. He's a lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of Neoliberal Prisons and Cognitive Treatment, as well as Missynchronization of Juvenile Reform. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have all three of you here with us. We're trying to understand what's going on here on the deeper levels. Kimberly Kahn, this is an area that you've been studying, racial bias in policing. Maybe we start about the different levels of bias and how they manifest themselves, both in society and specifically with police forces.
It's really important to consider policing as just a microcosm for the same sort of societal practices and biases that we see across all different domains within society, in education, in healthcare, in organizational structures. What myself and other social psychologists look at are the two kind of different levels of bias, and particularly how modern bias functions. So when we think of traditional attitudes, we tend to think of our explicit or kind of conscious level attitudes. If I ask you what your attitude about a certain racial group is, you can easily respond with your feelings. However, we actually know from psychological research that there's a second level through which attitudes influence behavior, and that's called implicit attitudes or implicit stereotyping. And essentially, this type of bias operates beneath our conscious awareness. So individuals don't even necessarily know that they hold these types of stereotypic biases or associations. And it's really important then to consider that one can hold outwardly, explicitly egalitarian or unprejudiced attitudes, yet still hold these implicit biases. And that really is what makes modern bias so pernicious and pervasive, because many people hold these implicit unconscious biases while not being aware of it and being explicitly not prejudiced. So we end up with a sort of subtle form of modern racism or modern stereotyping and bias, where on the surface conscious level, people think that they're being egalitarian in their behavior, yet in certain situations, those implicit attitudes can actually influence behavior and lead to discriminatory outcomes. And I think we see both of these processes playing out within the policing context as well.
I remember an old experiment called the Dahl test that was back in the 50s and had an effect on Brown versus Board of Education. And I know since then, there have been a series of experiments that have also tested for these sorts of implicit subconscious biases. I wonder if you could give us a bit of an update. If the experiments are showing us that we've changed in society, or if we're still the same as back in the 50s with the Dahl test, what are those experiments that are helping us understand this?
I think that's a great way to kind of get again at this nature of modern prejudice. What we tend to see over the last 50 years in the psychological literature is that people are less likely to explicitly endorse racial group stereotypes, gender stereotypes. Those overall numbers have gone down. However, what we've seen instead is this increase in implicit bias, in that unconscious bias. So that tends to be where more of the sort of focus is going. What are some of those types of experiments? How do we essentially measure someone's attitudes that are beneath their conscious awareness? And so what psychological researchers have created, one dominant methodology is called the implicit association task. And essentially what this task is we just sort categories and names into different categories that are either stereotype consistent or stereotype inconsistent. So we might have pairings of black and bad and white and good, for example. And the faster we're able just to sort different stimuli into those categories, we're faster to do that when those pairings are already primed in our mind. And so the faster we're able to do those sorting tasks when those sortings are stereotype consistent versus when they're stereotype inconsistent, is the strength of that implicit attitude that I mentioned. And so when we're talking about these reaction times, we're really thinking about the millisecond level. So we're not able to actually control these differences. But how does that play out and influence our behavior? Well, in the policing context, one way that we see implicit attitudes influence police behavior is through what's called a shooter bias phenomenon. And so this is the idea that police officers, as well as community members, are faster to correctly shoot in simulations African Americans that are carrying guns compared to whites. And then we also make the errors in stereotype consistent ways. So people are more likely to mistakenly shoot unarmed African-American targets compared to unarmed whites, and then make the opposite error, so you're more likely to mistakenly not shoot an armed white suspect, so someone that actually is dangerous, compared to an armed black suspect. So we can create these types of psychological simulations, and at this millisecond level, people are using race as a cue to understand whether or not to shoot or not shoot an individual based on the danger perceptions that we hold.
Is this part of what I saw in your work called weapon misidentification too?
Absolutely. So weapon misidentification is built off of this idea of shooter bias. So essentially, it's how the racial stereotypes that we hold at this implicit level bias our decision making in these sort of shoot, don't shoot simulations. So we get at how those implicit stereotypes are actually driving and biasing behavior.
So Alan Zhao, let's bring you in now and talk about how culture affects this type of police behavior. What are your findings telling us?
I look at kind of the other aspect of this organizational issues regarding police corruption, police misconduct, from mostly an organizational and institutional perspective. Basically, what I look at is how organizations change over time, and say from a corrupt police department to a much cleaner police department, from a department that engaged in a lot of misconduct, a lot of scandals, to a relatively more rights-conscious and more protection of individual civil rights, constitutional rights. Those kinds of departments, basically in the United States, I studied the changes in the Los Angeles Police Department from the earliest Rodney King beating. That's probably the first videotaped incident. And to the present, you hardly hear very much from Los Angeles these days. There is a good reason for that, because after the Rodney King beating incident, there was this Christopher Commission, and then the Rampart Board of Inquiry. The LAPD basically reached a consent decree with the Federal Department of Justice. And under that decree, the LAPD was mandated to carry out a series of reform, and they created an audit division, conducting about 50 audits per year, and then report the results of the audits and the response to those audits to a federal judge. And the entire department has changed over time. In a way, I like to use the LAPD as an example that a corrupt department with a lot of violation of individual rights, police brutality against African Americans, minorities, they can change. In a way, it's not been discussed much in the public media, but in a way, I believe the LAPD actually can be considered as a model today.
Do you know, Alan Zhao, sorry to interrupt you, how much it changed? Do you know, like, how many incidents, say, percentage-wise have decreased or reduced, or how much of an impact it did make, that commission?
Yes, basically, the consent decree required that the LAPD actually complete that consent decree. And the LAPD actually has successfully completed the decree. In other words, they have demonstrated compliance with all the issues identified in the consent decree, and the federal judge basically has allowed them to say, you have passed the test. And what it is that the consent decree is focused on what they call pattern and practice. There's a constitutional violation to the point where it's a pattern and practice, not just individual incidents. And that pattern and practice has been, in a way, they can say, drastically reduced. And these days, they still happen. Obviously, it's isolated incidents. So the pattern and practice probably has been drastically eliminated. And so in a sense, we can also look at all the surveys and the number, as you mentioned, numbers. And based on their records and the citizen survey, there has been a much better relationship and trust between the police and the community. So basically, the police are very difficult to change because their culture and their history, their tradition, their paramilitary nature, it's very difficult to change the police, which is very, very well documented. But there are stories of success, both in the United States and overseas. I was in Hong Kong for 1 year just to study the transition from the Royal Hong Kong Police to a Chinese military region police, how the Hong Kong police transformed from a syndically corrupt police department in 1970s to a department today that is relatively free of corruption. And they have gone through about three decades of change. Basically, I view it as a dramatic cultural transformation, and there are many factors that contributed to the change. One major factor is, in a way, it's another version of the consent decree, but in Hong Kong is the ICAC, which is the Independent Commission Against Corruption, which is an extremely powerful external oversight agency, leaving no stones unturned, looking into every corrupt case within the Hong Kong police. Over time, police officers just know if you are corrupt, you will be caught. They actually tell each other not to be corrupt. So that's a sea change from the 1970s when everybody was corrupt. So my research basically says that police can change, but it takes maybe two decades, maybe three decades to transform the culture of the police. But the force of this change usually was imposed upon the police coming from the outside. Most of the time, that seemed to be the case. Now, obviously, inside is important too, but usually it's the public outcry that forced an institutional change, not just a commission, a temporary commission or a temporary investigation. The consent decree is different from the Christopher Commission, from the Rampart Board of Inquiry, from many temporary investigative agencies all around the world. They don't seem to work very well, including the Civilian Review Board. They are incident driven. They're not put in there to watch over this agency through a legal system and through the justice system. In case of the consent decree, it's entirely different from the Christopher Commission report. It's a legal document. The LAPD was the defendant. The Department of Justice of the federal government was the plaintiff. That's the legal document. They have to comply. If they don't comply, something's consequential is going to happen to the police department. And this audit division has become part of the institution. And even though the consent decree has been completed, audit division continue to conduct audits, 50 audits a year. And that has become part of the institutionalized culture. Over time, based on my research, the police commanders have also become more receptive to the function, to the practices of this audit division. From the earlier resentment and sabotage, if you will, to the present cooperation, they actually look at it as a way to help them improve their operations, to improve their job. In the same way, the Hong Kong police actually view the ICAC in a much more positive term. If you look at in history, they would engage in workout strikes and demonstrations against the ICAC. To the present day, they will talk about, they will say that, you know, there is a problem, obviously we'll get to the bottom of it, because the good officers, good commanders benefit from the ICAC. And so they don't see there is a contradiction anymore as they used to. So things can change. There are models there to follow. There are best practices in the United States, such as the early warning system, the use of force policy, civilian review board. In recent years, there has been a trend called this Office of Independent Police Auditor. That has been developed mostly in western part of the United States. Probably about 50 cities already have it. A municipal independent agency charged with the responsibility to investigate police corruption and police misconduct, which is an external agency, not part of the police, usually operate directly under the mayor or city council. So these kinds of mechanism I view as best practices in rooting out the scandals we've been seeing in Ferguson and Baltimore.
Ronald Kramer, what do you make of all this?
My work is more about social structure, social inequality, and criminal justice, a bit more broadly conceived and things like that. So I think it's interesting to hear the LAPD of all places, you know, as becoming a model of good policing. But I think the flip side of that for me is, you know, there's also, while there is change and while that is possible, and it's interesting how difficult it seems to be to create that change and how much oversight and regulation it requires. But on the other side of that, there's a very long history of ongoing structural oppression, persistent forms of discrimination across all aspects of criminal justice. I sort of see all this as largely connected to growing social inequalities. The last 40 45 years under neoliberal regimes and governments, neoliberal forms of statecrafting, life has gotten worse and worse for the vast majority of people. Inequality has gotten incredibly worse. The gap has grown, especially in the US. It's growing in New Zealand. We're on that same sort of path here. Same case in Australia, pretty much the same thing in the UK. All those sort of neoliberal countries have seen those same sorts of transformations, precarious labour, exclusion from the labour market and things like that. And that often correlates with race, which I think is a reflection of the fact that capitalism is a, you know, racially discriminatory economic order. And then what we seem to be doing more and more in the last, you know, in this same period is turning to criminal justice, turning to the police to sort of manage the social problems that follow as inequality gets worse. I think in that context, places like LA, the LAPD, I would guess they're more likely to be something of the exception to the rule, which is a little more pessimistic, sorry to say. So yeah, I think that's kind of how I would see it. When we look at all the criminal justice figures, it's not really a story of progress for the most part. Incarceration is getting worse and worse. There seems to be, you know, if anything, more and more incidents of police brutality and excessive police force, especially in the US. And I think the other thing to think about, the police shootings, you know, the arresting the teenagers at a pool party and, I don't know, that cop rolling around on the ground in the video, all those kinds of absurdities. In some sense, they're on the extreme end. The other side to this is the more, you know, the everyday kind of policing. When I was in New York, I was doing a study on young men in Rikers Island who were in a cognitive treatment program. And one of the things I would sort of talk a lot about is just the ongoing police presence in their neighborhood. It didn't always need to be a shooting. It was just constant harassment going on in the neighborhood and things like that. So I think that sort of signifies it's an uphill battle to sort of correct those broader structural problems. And I think it's nice to see that there is things at the organizational level or organizational sort of mechanisms and best practices that you can implement. But I think we need to be aware of the task and the problem that we're really up against if we're interested in seeing, you know, what could be called progressive or, you know, less violent forms of policing or whatever you want to call it.
I wonder, too, when we look at China and Hong Kong in comparison to, say, the United States has got more diversity both in terms of race and ethnicity and also in terms of the economic structures. And I wonder, Alan Zhao, if you think that the heterogeneity in the United States makes it more complicated than, say, the systems that you studied in China in terms of in-group and out-group and cultural differences, that sort of a thing. What's your sense about that?
Hong Kong has a very different culture, obviously. Hong Kong is known for having a very low crime rate in recent years. But racism or discrimination against certain members of certain ethnic group, they do exist in Hong Kong as well. It's just they haven't, you know, come up as scandals covered in the media. Obviously, they haven't got that serious in Hong Kong. But the police officers I talked to when I was there, they actually have even more open discriminatory attitudes than American police officers I talked to. In the United States, it's a very sensitive because the racial issue. You really don't hear much about racism when you talk to police officers, but you talk to a Hong Kong police officer, they are openly racist in a way. They don't think it's anything wrong to say that why you wear the scarf, you know, you want to live here, you live like a Chinese person, you know, it's yourself to blame. The civil rights, that part has not caught up. They've done a great job controlling crime in Hong Kong and have done a great job controlling corruption. And to a certain extent, they also have done a great job controlling misconduct, misbehavior. But actually, one weak area in the Hong Kong police that I saw is civil rights and is areas like the United States have developed much further ahead, such as domestic violence legislation. Hong Kong, when I was there, still did not have any laws governing domestic violence. It is remained a family issue that police simply did not want to be involved in. And the United States was like that in the 1970s. It's like 40 years ago. And these days, a lot more protection and legal protection has been created for women, for minorities. So the race consciousness was much stronger in the United States, even though the media seemed to portray, obviously, a lot more problems. In a way, I agree with Ron, actually. It is extremely difficult to change the culture and mindsets and behavior of police organization, both at the organizational level and at the individual level, which is why my research has pointed to the importance of not just a simple change, not just a simple commission sent to investigate. It really has to get to the point of institutionalized change. The change should continue regardless who was the chief of police, regardless who was there today or gone tomorrow. And oftentimes it's based on an individual person there, and the person's gone, the whole program is gone. Institutionalized change means the culture has to be created and established. And that would take, as I said earlier, years and even decades. And somebody has to be there as a permanent body, holding them accountable, like the ICAC in Hong Kong. And this consent decree in Los Angeles, there's a reason why they have changed. They were forced to change initially, but eventually they become receptive and they welcome this oversight. And the United States, I agree, this is not a rule. It is an exception. Unfortunately, it is true. But they do exist. I want to shed a positive light. Another example is Oakland, which is not too far. It's also in Los Angeles. Oakland used to be extremely corrupt. The officers there, it just about everybody was behaving extremely badly. They could kill somebody and be covered up. Everybody would protect them. It's because of public protests about 15, 20 years ago, very, very strong protests citywide that forced the Oakland police to change. And these days, Oakland police is also getting much better. I'm not saying that the problem, have stopped. But they are making progress in many areas. It is still rare and far in between. But I think that the police are required. Unfortunately, they're not forced to do anything. The police in America are all independent. There's no national police system. Nobody has to do anything. We're all under the mayor, under each city, So if the police are required, say, to follow a set of what I like to call the best practices in policing, if they are mandated, let's say, by some kind of a legal mechanism, oversight, that they have to have a set of best practices in place and on a permanent basis. We all know what they are. They are best practices. There are probably 10, 15, 20 best practices models already out there, but they are not required to be followed. And unfortunately, probably 90% of the police department don't follow those best practices, even though they're readily available to follow. For example, early warning system can be easily adopted. Many agencies still don't use it. And it's simple as that. Independent police auditor can be easily created, but very few cities do that in the United States. So it is a very difficult task ahead, which I totally agree with Ron, and require institutionalized effort, not just a temporary police investigative commission. It's not just something like that. So that whoever wants to make the change have to have this long-term commitment to making the change happen at the institutional level as well as the individual level.
Kimberly Kahn, let's bring you back in then. Are these best practices going to help us to deal with these subconscious racial biases?
And that's the tricky part. Not necessarily. As we can find, we might see these best practices and these structural changes we can make within departments, change some of those explicit norms or ideas. Policing is still happening within the broader societal context. And if we're not changing the broader societal context and the structures, the way our stereotypes have already been implicitly adopted and embedded in our mind are still going to function within those contexts. So those implicit attitudes that I was talking about before are really created by just the knowledge of these cultural stereotypes that link, racial minorities or blacks with criminality and violence. And what we see is those stereotypes then impact our daily decisions and our behaviors in both overt ways as well as these subtle ways. So it might bias where an officer's natural attention goes to in a crowd. It's going to change and shape the information that we take in to be in line with the stereotype. So we might see an ambiguous action and interpret it as more threatening or dangerous when it's done by an African-American suspect compared to a white suspect. It might then, you know, influence our interactions when police are interacting with minorities. And then it might also influence the level of force if the incident actually escalates. And all of this can be done then beneath people's conscious awareness. So changing the explicit norms and changing the institutional structure is certainly a really good starting point, but it doesn't really get at the more prevalent influence of these implicit biases in directing police behavior.
Does it matter who decides to become an officer? Is there a type of person who decides to enter the police force? And within that police force, there's got to be a culture that develops in a sort of in-group, out-group thinking. Is there a phenomenon there that can be or should be addressed?
From a psychological profile, there does tend to be a certain type of individual that is attracted, is more likely to enter the policing realm. They tend to, you know, be a little more kind of comfortable with sort of dominance and power and kind of enforcing control and authority. Those are some of the basic tenets that are part of an officer's job. So it tends to attract those types of individuals to a greater extent compared to another type of job. So we have some self-selection of individuals that are more kind of into or comfortable with sort of taking authority, leadership, kind of power and control over a situation. So that can kind of start to lead situations to already have that power basic and that basis and that moral authority given to the officer.
And then what about training? How much does that matter?
Absolutely. You know, and with training academies, as police go through the academy, they tend to, that's where officers tend to learn those norms. We know that policing, for example, is a very masculine focused arena or focused domain. So those masculine type ideas of control and power and authority tend to be emphasized, learned, and adopted in the academy, which then translate into their police officers' work in the field. And that's really where those types of institutional norms that we're talking about earlier are first learned. And so any kind of change, you really want to start at that academy level, going all the way through the upper echelon and leadership within the department.
Alan Zhao, what do you say about that?
My research basically suggests that the police profession obviously draws those personalities Kim just described, but also other kinds of people, because young people actually in the United States, at least, are drawn to the police profession basically because of the media. Basically, it's a free advertising for the police profession, the FBI, the cop show, and all this court TV. The power for influencing the officers to a great extent come from the time after they enter the police force, after they finish the training. The first 6 months to about a year, what we call this probationary period in police departments, police officers would go through a very powerful socialization process. Either you are in or you are out. And it is an extremely powerful process that pretty much shapes and changes a lot of people's personalities to conform to the norm of whether it's bad or good. It's, oftentimes if it's a corrupt culture, you would be forced to be part of that. Or if it's a good culture, become part of that. But at the end, I think that socialization process needs to be recognized. That's why this institutional cultural program is extremely important to make sure that a more positive, right conscious principles need to be indoctrinated in the mind and hearts of these officers. Those in the first year, extremely important. Obviously, officers like to follow their relatives and parents or grandparents. Somebody did a study called Dangerous Footstep, basically like four different generations of cops in the United States. And so that represents a certain pattern. But based on my students that I teach, they come from all walks and backgrounds. They're all drawn to this profession because of what they see on TV pretty much. But at the end, somebody else, I forgot his name, did a study. Actually, he compared four different personalities of four different police officers, and they actually approach incidents, respond to incidents, dealing with the same problem in four different ways. So they still have some discretion. They still can do things that reflect their different personality. They don't use the same methods to, let's say, to deal with domestic violence. And some officers would avoid, try not to do the paperwork. Others would come in from this social justice perspective. Others would look at it from a sociological perspective, you know, look at the children, look at the friends, look at the, who's going to bring the food to the table. Other people just like, I'm here for justice. I don't care who you are. I'm going to arrest the person. So there are four different perspectives dealing with the same issue. So personalities still matter. They're not all the same, even though maybe in terms of relationship, who they hang out with, you know, they have to conform with their fellow officer, but they do work on an individual basis in the United States. They work alone most of the time. So when they deal with problems, they have all kinds of discretions.
Ronald Kramer, what do you say to all this?
Yeah, I kind of feel we're going to be caught between the sort of how much conscious manipulation can go on and how the extent to which that can challenge sort of, as I should have said before, like the kind of social structure that I was talking about, I think it does weave its way into the sort of mindset and the sort of subjectivity of people and things like that. So I feel we're sort of trapped between these, what we consciously can do against the structures that we're in and the sort of subjectivity that we bring to them. The thing that triggered for me was I think there's actually quite a common social phenomenon on some sense. People go into a profession with whatever motive they may have, but they come out of it, or once they are on the other side and involved in that profession, they tend to do whatever the structure asks and demands of them. I see, for, you know, just this is a bit anecdotal, obviously, but can't tell you how many law students I've met who wanted to be Erin Brockovich or whatever, and then they get into the legal field and they realize how the law actually operates or something like that, you know. And again, I really probably shouldn't say this, again, completely anecdotal, but, you know, academics, it's like, hey, let's all teach and be like these inspirations to people. And then you get inside an academic institution and you realize, you know, no one really cares about that. It's what's your research? What are you doing? Are you getting funded? And that's sort of, then you become that kind of academic.
I saw the same thing in the state legislature, too. Exactly. Want to get in, change the world, and conformity.
You know, so a lot of, I think there's... there's these sort of ritualistic elements of entering any given profession. And again, I think the police force is probably has a pretty disturbing version of that. I've heard that said in the New Zealand context in some of the interviews I've done around criminal justice, people saying you learn all this stuff in the academy and then the first cop you're on the beat with or whatever pulls you aside and says this is how it really works and things like that. So I think we're still up against that dynamic of how much can you sort of consciously or sort of through programs manipulate the structures that people are embedded within and things like that. And again, I understand there can be best practices and very positive versions of that. But again, I think it's still evident that we have a significant problem in these regards. And so the question becomes perhaps something, what's the likelihood or how is it that you can promote those kinds of programs and get buy into them or something like that? Maybe it's time to start thinking strategically about how you can implement those kinds of things in a consistent fashion.
It brings to mind something I saw in your work too, Alan Zhao, which is about community policing. What has been the impact of that?
Community policing, I think, is a great way to bridge the gap between the police and the community, obviously. Again, community policing can only work if the police actually have developed a community-oriented culture. Again, this cannot be at the rhetoric level or some leader, police manager wants to do it. The police office, the rank and file have to have this buy-in process, has become part of their culture. And that part, I don't think has taken place in most places, just like everything else. It hasn't happened, even though community policing has been around, you know, since the 80s, since the team policing program was put into place in the 70s. But based on my research, it really hasn't taken root, even though it's a catchy word, it's a buzzword that everybody likes to use. And over time, actually, it has been eroded after the 9/11 terrorist attack, because the funding from the federal government for community policing has all been diverted to Homeland Security. And the police basically have been reverted back to the traditional bureaucratic professional model, which what we like to call today, they like to use the word evidence-based policing or intelligence-based policing. These new words keep coming up. You know, community policing, it seemed to be an old concept already, even though it has never taken root in the first place. But again, one more word. But if a department, again, would like to use a good model, like the San Diego Police Department, actually, I think is a good model for community policing, at least in the, say, 20 years ago. Again, it's because it was institutionalized. It's not just the isolated anecdotal program somebody liked and created in one day, then a person left the force the next year. It is something that the San Diego Police Department wants to use as a guiding principle for every division, every program, every unit, not just a separate, say, community policing program within a patrol division, which is what most places do. They actually use the same idea to govern the operations of every police activity. So you have to do something like that, really committed to this idea. Understand this is not just a catchy phrase to use, as require a lot of changes, like including how you promote officers, how you evaluate officers. It's not just counting how many arrests you have made and how many tickets you have given, but also look at the compliments, how many problems you have solved, how many collaborative effort you have, how many people have reached out. So that has to be a different evaluation system put into place. And most departments, unfortunately, don't want to go that far. And they're comfortable with just counting arrests, counting tickets, not comfortable with this, you know, soft criteria. They like to use the hard criteria, as they say. So that's why it's difficult to do. I think it's a culture they have to create. And by the way, I don't think community policing is a concept that came from the United States. Even a lot of people think it came from the United States. Actually, it came from Japan. David Bailey, the first person who created this term, he used those two words to characterize the Japanese policing. So the first American scholar used that phrase, and people think it came from America, actually came from Japan. He used those two terms to describe the Japanese way of policing, the Koban system, which existed in Japan, obviously does not exist in the United States.
I know they were also trying something like that in Northern Ireland, where there was historically, the police were used to oppress the Irish Catholic community, and they were trying to do some form of community policing to try to make that a more equitable system. Kimberly Kahn, where do you think we should go to create a more just police force and justice system?
That's the difference of going from just that enforcement model, which is what was sort of just described, to the more community engagement type model, the more kind of collaborative policing approach, where, again, you're really valuing positive interactions between officers and citizens. And that's seen as part of normal police work and just as important as the number of citations or arrests that you made. And so why does community policing have such a buzzword, or why does that have potentially these better outcomes? Is because if it's done correctly and with the community, it can increase the trust in police that community members have, and particularly the minority community. So what we tend to see is that minority group members tend to have lower levels of trust in the police than majority group members. And this creates a disconnect between the police and the communities that they're trying to serve. And we know that lower levels of trust in police then affect people's willingness to cooperate with the police, willingness to call the police if they are a victim of the crime. And part of police officers' jobs and ability to do their jobs well is that connection with the community to get tips, to get information, to help solve crimes. And when we have this gap in trust in police, then it makes police actually less effective at their overall job. And so what these positive community interactions, police suspect interactions can have, is actually serve to try to reduce that gap in trust between racial minorities and majority group members by having more of these positive, non-investigatory contacts. Simply going out and meeting the community members, talking to businesses, business owners, learning about the problems in the community. In our local context, we have officers go out to attend the sporting event games, for example, and pass out stickers with kids. And it's all of those basic interactions where community members start to see police just in their normal daily lives and in a non-investigatory way that helps to create that trust and create that bond, which then leads to more positive police community relationships and interactions afterwards.
Ronald Kramer?
No, thanks. I agree with most of what's been said. The only thing I would sort of add is, one is community policing can mean a whole bunch of different things, as was intimated in New York. I think it clearly meant something different than how some other places understood it. And again, as a sociologist, the more broader point for me, one of the things I think we need to start thinking about is, I think we're too dependent on criminal justice. I think we ask the criminal justice system to do too much for us at this point. So I think, you know, we need to think of ways to minimize our dependence on police, minimize our dependence on courts and prisons and things like that. One of the things I sort of didn't say before was that as we've sort of seen criminal justice expand, we've seen other forms of social support be eradicated over this same time period. And so I think there, alongside more progressive ideas about how to police, there also needs to be more progressive ideas or reinvestments in old sort of public infrastructure, social security systems that were previously in place in many of these sorts of places. Well, at least my focus being the more sort of so-called Western democracies in some sense. So they've been eradicated. You know, it came up before that there's the introduction of specialized courts, you know, in the US around family violence. That's just one example of what I'm talking about. There's a proliferation of specialized courts now, family violence courts, drug courts. In New Zealand, we have a homelessness court effectively, right? In a lot of ways, family violence perhaps not so much, but drugs, homelessness, they're fundamental social problems. I don't understand why we're asking criminal justice to... I don't understand why we're tasking criminal justice with those issues. But we have no alternative social model. So I think in conjunction with rethinking how we police, we need to rethink and reinvest in social security that we in some places took for granted in the 60s, 70s, you know, to some extent.
I think this was a profound discussion. We got to a lot of things in a short amount of time. Thank you, all three of you, for being with us. Alan Zhao, Kimberly Khan, and Ronald Kramer. What a great pleasure to host you.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kimberly Barsamian Khan is a professor of social psychology at Portland State University. She's the author of Racial Bias in Policing, Why We Know Less Than We Should. Alan Zhao is a professor of law and justice at Rowan University. He is the author of Controlling Police Corruption and Misconduct, a comparative examination between Hong Kong and New York, as well as Police Auditing Theories and Practices. Ronald Kramer is a lecturer at the University of Auckland and the author of Neoliberal Prisons and Cognitive Treatment, as well as Missynchronization of Juvenile Reform. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.